ATM machines have to be filled. The stores need to know, because they have to make sure they have enough money when we do the direct deposit.
Preparing for an early arrival of the PFD. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 20th of August. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, the Coast Guard suspends its search for Deputy Revenue Commissioner Brian Andrews and his son.
It's very difficult to see wreckage, particularly if it's in a dense woods, tall canopy, tall trees, etc.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
A Washington, D.C. jury will sit in judgment on Senator Ted Stevens. Stevens lost his bid today to move his federal trial to Alaska. He faces criminal charges of lying on his Senate financial disclosure forms to hide gifts worth more than $250,000. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington that the decision is a blow to Stevens' defense.
U.S. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan denied Senator Stevens' motion to move his case to Alaska after an hour spent hearing both sides' arguments. Judge Sullivan said the two strongest reasons to move the trial are the location of witnesses, most of whom are in Alaska, and the disruption to Stevens' business, which is campaigning. But the judge said those reasons were outweighed by the arguments against moving the case north. The judge said staying in Washington won't be an undue inconvenience for Stevens since he has a home nearby. He contrasted that with a different case in which the defendant was too poor to afford staying in an unfamiliar city far from home. Lawyers for both sides say they expect to call about 40 witnesses, and they aren't sure yet how much their witness lists overlap. Defense attorney Brendan Sullivan pulled out a map of the U.S. to show just how far away Alaska is from D.C. and said repeatedly that this is, quote, the first case in the history of the Republic where so many witnesses will have to travel 7,000 miles round trip to testify. But the judge said Stevens' lawyers did not prove that witnesses would be unable to travel from Alaska to Washington, and he said those who can't make the trip can testify over state-of-the-art video conferencing technology. The defense argued that the case is all about Alaska, but the judge sided with the prosecution that much of the alleged crime took place in the nation's capital. That's where Stevens filled out and signed financial disclosure forms, and the prosecution says it's also where relevant phone calls, faxes, and vehicle swaps took place. As for the defense team's argument that jurors need to see Stevens' Girdwood home, which was allegedly renovated as a gift, the judge said the house is not a crime scene, but evidence, which can be viewed through pictures and videos. And Judge Sullivan sided with the prosecution's opinion that Stevens' campaign is actually a reason not to move the case to Alaska, because all of the media exposure and campaigning have a potential risk of influencing jurors. Prosecutor Nicholas Marsh said his office has, quote, more than a little heartburn over Stevens' argument that the trial will disrupt his business of campaigning. Marsh complained that it was unfair of the senator to ask that the case be fast-tracked and tried before November's election and then use the election as a reason to change venue. Judge Sullivan said he's sympathetic to Stevens' need to campaign, so he suggested the court sit 4 days a week, allowing Stevens to visit Alaska on long weekends to stump for office. Stevens' lawyer was hesitant to agree, since it might prolong the trial deeper into election season. He proposed instead that they start out with a 5-day-a-week schedule and take long weekends if the trial makes progress. It's estimated the case will take about 4 weeks. The court has a month to hammer out the details. Jury selection is set to begin September 22nd, with the trial starting 2 days later. Senator Stevens did not appear in court today, choosing instead to stay in Alaska and campaign for next week's primary. He issued a statement saying that he understands the court's decision, continues to have faith in the fairness of the judicial system, and that he welcomes the opportunity to demonstrate his innocence. Political watchers said Stevens would have found a friendlier jury pool in Alaska, where he served as a powerful senator for 40 years. That point didn't come up at Wednesday's hearing. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
Senator Stevens' Washington office announced today that he's setting up a legal defense fund. Stevens' attorneys are in the process of seeking approval from the Senate Ethics Committee to start such a fund, which allows members to raise money to help pay legal fees. Once it's established, they'll have to file regular reports listing all contributors and expenses. Lobbyists, corporations, and unions cannot contribute to legal defense funds, and the money cannot be spent on anything other than Stevens' personal legal fees. Alaska's Congressman Don Young also has a legal fund, which he started in January. It raised no money in the first quarter, but the most recent filing late last month showed it contained $54,000. Young is the subject of a federal investigation, and his legal bills have totaled more than $1 million. He's come under strong criticism using campaign dollars to pay his legal fees. Governor Sarah Palin announced today the first round of permanent fund dividend checks will be deposited early this year on September 12th. The checks will include an extra $1,200 state lawmakers approved to help offset the high cost of fuel. From member station KHNS, Diana Burrow reports.
Jerry Burnett is the director of administrative services for the Alaska Department of Revenue. Burnett says the original plan was to send out the PFD in November and the $1,200 resource rebate earlier as a separate check in August.
When the legislature chose to have it sent out with the PFD, which is the way the bill passed, then the governor asked the Department of Revenue to look at how we could get PFDs so that that extra money and the money from the PFD, you know, so people would have it in time.
In the meantime, Burnett says the Department of Revenue is communicating with financial institutions to prepare them for the early payout.
ATM machines have to be filled. The stores need to know because they have to make sure they have enough money when we do the direct deposits.
Though the calculations are not final, Burnett estimates this year's PFD to be near $2,000. With the added resource rebate, checks should be between $3,100 and $3,300 per person. This adds up to a total of just under $2 billion for the state. If PFD checks are sent out a month earlier, that $2 billion has less time to accrue interest. But Burnett assures that the lost interest will have no effect on future PFD funds.
The interest on that money goes to the general fund, so it doesn't affect PFDs. And we think it's more important to get the money into the hands of Alaskans than it is for the state to earn a little bit of interest on that money.
Previously, PFD checks were not scheduled to go out until November 14th. Direct deposits were planned for October 2nd and October 16th. Reporting in Haines, I'm Diana Borrow.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a primary matchup between two men who say they're committed to ethics in government.
If you don't end the corruption, all else kind of seems to be a sidebar to all that.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the new AT&T, your world delivered.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The Coast Guard has suspended its search for Deputy Revenue Commissioner Brian Andrews and his 24-year-old son, Brandon. The men disappeared on August 9th in the process of shuttling camping gear between Young Lake on Admiralty Island and Juneau. The Coast Guard deployed a helicopter that evening, and since then the search effort has included the military, state, civil air patrol, commercial pilots, and Good Samaritans. The Coast Guard cutter Liberty, a fish and game research vessel, and volunteer boaters have been on the water, and rescue teams and volunteer hikers are working the ground. But so far they've found nothing. The Coast Guard says it will resume the search when there are new developments, while volunteers will keep searching. K2's Rosemarie Alexander flew with the Civil Air Patrol this week and has this story.
Clear left.
Clear right.
Clear right.
The Cessna 206 taxis the airport runway. On this flight, Civil Air Patrol Major Jeff DeFriest is at the controls. Rick Fritch is a co-pilot and chief observer. The Coast Guard has assigned the CAP a route from Mansfield Peninsula to Taku Inlet. Sketched on a map, the outline resembles a Tyrannosaurus Rex. CAP Commander Ken Nessler and another observer fly up Taku Inlet to Twin Glacier Lake. We fly down Gastineau Channel and begin searching at Marmion Island. A Coast Guard Jayhawk is in the vicinity. After the foggy weekend, the aircraft are making up for lost time. Coast Guard Operations Specialist Adam DeRocher coordinates the search patterns and on this day deploys a TEMSCO helicopter along Stevens Passage from Point Arden to Point Retreat. A North Star trekking helicopter takes the lower elevations on the west side of Mansfield Peninsula and Douglas Island. A volunteer boat also searches the backside of Douglas. The Coast Guard Jayhawk flies four different routes and checks out leads from other aircraft. CAP pilot DeFriest maintains an altitude of 1,000 feet, flying at about 100 knots. Observer Rick Fritch scans the water for oil sheens. He looks for shapes in the shallows that could be airplane parts. The beach is mostly littered with driftwood. Only a few things stand out. On a second pass, something that looks like a seat cushion is actually a rock. A large white object is an old skiff on its side.
There's a lot of scenery going by fairly fast at the altitudes and the speeds that we're working with. So I'm looking for things that break the normal pattern. I'm looking for unnatural shapes on the beach or unnatural colors on the beach. Most of the airplanes you see flying around are white. So white objects that are usually either square, rectangular, or shapes that have right angles to them are things that catch the eye.
He spots a large white rectangular shape on an Admiralty Cove beach. DeFriest circles above and calls the Coast Guard. The helicopter flies over to take a look at lower altitude. Rust indicates it's been there a while. The route takes us over open muskeg and dense stands of timber. Glints of sunlight on ponds deep in the trees can be mistaken for objects. On this day, with high clouds and some blue sky, it's almost easy to forget how unforgiving the terrain below can be. Fritch is looking for a change in the tree pattern. Suddenly, he sees a break in the canopy.
There's like five or six trees. They're all fallen in a row. There's no bare dirt on the ground.
We circle again and notify the Jayhawk of the location. Much of the 11-day search has been stymied by fog and low clouds. Good weather on Monday and Tuesday produced nothing. The Coast Guard's DeRocher counts 60 sorties among the federal, state, and local aircraft and boats.
4,866 nautical miles that we have searched.
The Coast Guard has even been using night vision goggles and infrared heat sensors.
They were just picking up deer and bears and stuff like that.
Is this getting frustrating?
Yes, it is. I know that everybody, the communities, all come together and everybody's trying to figure out if there's anything that we've missed, where else we could search. These are always tough when they go this long.
Jim LaBelle is the Alaska Region Director for the National Transportation Safety Board. The agency investigates every civil aviation accident in the United States. He's been following the search from his office in Anchorage, waiting for a call that something has been found.
It's very difficult to see wreckage, particularly if it's in a dense woods, tall canopy, tall trees, etc. Even when you know where the accident site is, when you fly back to them in a helicopter and try and locate them again.
LaBelle has been with the NTSB for 22 years and on hundreds of investigations. He says about every 18 months, an aircraft disappearance in Alaska goes unresolved.
It is the proverbial needle in a haystack.
The Andrews were flying a white Cessna 182 with red and silver trim. The tail number is N9350X. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The national news media and local pollsters are already talking about a general election matchup between Ted Stevens and Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich in the U.S. Senate race. But first, Begich has to make it through the next week's Democratic primary, where he faces anti-corruption crusader Ray Metcalf. APRN's Annie Fight reports.
Mark Begich is running as a Democrat, but you'll hear him use the word independent much more often.
So my hope is to represent Alaska as an independent in the sense of Alaska is first.
Begich says his political style has always been to work across party lines, and that's what he intends to do if elected to the Senate.
And I think that's what's made me successful as mayor of Anchorage, on the U.S. Conference of Mayors on a national level, as a former sitting assembly member for 9.5 years, was I was not afraid to walk across the line and say, you know, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Green Party or whatever, we got issues to deal with, and we need to deal with them because at the end of the day, we need results that Alaska families are waiting for.
The 46-year-old mayor was born in Anchorage. His father, Nick, served in the state Senate and was then elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. His plane disappeared in the Gulf of Alaska when he was campaigning for re-election in 1972. Mark was 10 years old. He was first elected to the Anchorage Assembly at age 26 and is now in his second term as mayor. He says he decided to run for U.S. Senate because he sees great changes occurring in Alaska.
I look at Alaska, and being born and raised here, it's clear in my mind that the demographics of Alaska have changed, and they're looking more long-term. They're looking the next 20, 30 years. What are we going to do today to make sure we don't fall into this energy crisis again that we're facing? That's one of the issues when I travel around the state I hear a lot about, or the healthcare mess that we're engaged in today in the sense of the lack of access for individuals.
Energy and healthcare are two issues Begich is highlighting in his campaign. He also wants to reform the country's education system, including getting rid of No Child Left Behind and providing universal funding for pre-K schooling. And he has an ethics plan that calls for more transparency in government.
Because I think it's important that you live to a higher standard. You have full financial disclosure of where your money comes from and your wife or your son, in my case, where all our revenue comes from in our household. Putting it on the web so people can have access to it. People who want to meet with me and lobbyists and so forth, my plan is to put my calendar on the web.
Begich is running against Ray Metcalf, who also has a passion for ethics and government. He introduces himself this way.
I'm the guy that exposed Vico and Ben Stevens for all their skullduggery.
Metcalf owns a real estate company and has served two terms in Alaska's House of Representatives as a Republican. He says he parted ways with the party over corruption, and that's his main issue today.
How can you trust anyone to go forward with the issue that they say they promised to promote if it's clear that such a large number of your politicians were taking bribes and to change their vote and change their opinion? And, you know, if you don't end the corruption, all else kind of seems to be a sidebar to all that.
But Metcalf, who will turn 58 next week, says he's not just a one-issue candidate.
I think that we should reverse the tax breaks that Bush gave his rich friends. I think that we need to get our troops out of Iraq just as quickly as we're able. I think that we have some unfinished business in Afghanistan. The guy that did bomb our towers got away.
Metcalf says it's frustrating to watch his opponent get so much national and local attention. And he faults the Alaska Democratic Party for offering an early endorsement and fundraising help to Begich.
Mark Begich would not be running for office against Ted Stevens had I not done what I did to expose Ben Stevens and Ted Stevens for their corruption and bribery. And that's the reason that they have this opportunity.
The Democratic U.S. Senate primary race also includes Homer resident Frank Vondersaar. He has run for the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate several times and describes his priorities as restoring open government and finding an end to the Iraq War. The statewide primary is August 26th. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas online. APRN would like to thank the Alaska Railroad Corporation for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
The state's environmental monitors are getting better access to the inside workings of cruise ships. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
A new report on the Ocean Rangers program says 26 of 28 ships granted full access in July. That's significantly better than an earlier report from May and June showing only 18 of 27 ships complying with access requirements. Denise Koch manages the State Department of Environmental Conservation's cruise ship program. She says she talked to the cruise lines after the earlier report, and they responded.
When we discovered that there were problems and the Ocean Rangers said that they weren't getting sufficient access, we then, you know, kind of asked ocean rangers, well, what are the things that are hindering your access? And once they gave us those examples, then I was able to go back and discuss those examples with the cruise lines and say, okay, these are the things that hinder access, and we need to eliminate these barriers.
Crowley Marine Services supervises the rangers on contract with the state. Its August 15th report, covering the month of July, shows one ranger having access problems on board two ships, Holland America's Stottendam and Princess's Diamond. Koch says other rangers were able to get full access on both ships, and she's confident the problems have been solved. Groups that put the program in place are pleased with the improvement, but Gershon Cohen of the Earth Island Institute says he's not canceling plans to sue to force better access. Instead, he says he's putting his legal action on hold.
It's unfortunate that it takes a little bit of a heavy hand from DEC and a heavy hand from the citizens of the state threatening a lawsuit to make it happen when the law was clear to begin with. But if that's what has to happen to make sure the law is obeyed, then that's what we'll have to do, and we'll do that again as we need to in the future.
About 25 rangers are riding the cruise ships this summer, monitoring air emissions and water discharges, plus a variety of environmental systems. Koch says they've reported wastewater and oil discharge problems that are being looked into.
There have been a number of items that we have referred to not only ourselves, we've also referred items potentially to, for example, the Coast Guard if they may be out of our jurisdiction. But we haven't finished a case yet where we can come back to you and say, yes, this was actually a compliance problem.
She says the state will release information once investigations are complete. That includes June's greywater discharge in Chatham Strait involving the Royal Caribbean ship Rhapsody of the Seas. Greywater comes from showers and sinks. The Ocean Rangers program is in its first full year of operation after being approved by voters in 2006. It was part of the cruise ship initiative, which also taxes passengers, onboard gambling, and corporate earnings. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The decision of whether four-time Iditarod champ Jeff King illegally killed a moose in Denali National Park now rests with a judge. A two-day trial on the matter wrapped up yesterday with King taking the stand in his own defense. If convicted, he faces up to a year in prison and a $10,000 fine. Chris Freiberg has been covering the trial for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, and he joins me now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Can you describe more specifically the charges? What exactly was he accused of?
Well, Jeff King is charged with two things. The first is illegally taking a moose within the boundary of Denali National Park, and the second charge is that he illegally drove a motor vehicle into the park.
All right. Now, as you said in the intro, he took the stand in his own defense. What was his main defense?
Well, the main defense from him and his attorney Myron Angstman was that the boundary isn't exactly clear. You can get a lot of maps in Alaska, even in Denali Park, that don't clearly show the boundary, and the markers there they say may not actually be the actual boundary. They also questioned whether the Park Service has the authority to make the boundary of the park, and they seem to believe that he was a good 800 feet from where the park lies.
His daughter also testified, as I understand it. What did she have to say?
Well, the main thing that his daughter had to say was she testified that she was the one who initially drove the Argo 8-wheeler into the kill site. Now, if the judge decides that the moose was killed inside of the park, that could mean that the judge would have trouble convicting him of driving the vehicle if his daughter was the one who did that.
Who was the main witness then for the prosecution?
The prosecution's main witness was Park Ranger John Leonard.
And what did he have to say? What was his testimony?
Well, the ranger testified that when at first he came upon Mr. King and his daughter, he didn't actually think that there was anything suspicious. He did say that Mr. King said he was out of practice and hadn't taken a moose in a while, which the defense rather disputes that. But he said that then he went to the kill site and he felt that someone had sneaked a moose out of the park. And as they investigated it, they realized that they felt Mr. King had taken this moose, which he doesn't deny.
All right. Now, what happens next? What's next on the agenda?
Well, because the trial lasted much longer than I think either attorney anticipated. I know Mr. King's attorney said that he'd planned for a flight back to Bethel yesterday afternoon, and testimony went past 5 o'clock on Tuesday. They've decided that closing arguments will be in written form to the judge, and for him to go through that, that'll take until at least September 25th, and then he'll issue a ruling after that.
All right. Is there any sense at all about how the judge may rule on this?
Well, after the prosecution rested, Mr. King's attorney made a motion for the case to be dismissed on several grounds. One of those was that he said the prosecution hadn't proved the charge of using a motor vehicle within the park. In fact, the park ranger had only testified that he had seen tracks. There is a photo of the Argo in the background of the dead moose, but no one's actually driving it. And the judge said that he felt maybe he could dismiss that charge, but he decided to let it stand. He said, you know, there's not necessarily enough evidence to convict on this, but we'll let it stand and we'll see where it goes.
All right, so we're looking for something around September 25th then.
Sometime after that.
All right, Chris Freiberg is a reporter with the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
All right, thank you.
Japan Airlines is maintaining its commitment to Alaska despite tough times for air carriers and a recession in Japan. The airline recently announced plans for at least 17 flights to Alaska this fall and winter, adding to its 15 summer flights. During the winter, most JAL planes fly into Fairbanks, where Japanese visitors come to see the Northern Lights. Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau Tourism Director Colin Lawrence says, like Americans, Japanese tourists aren't doing as much long-distance travel.
So actually, we're doing quite well with the charter flights because even though international visitation is up to the U.S., Japanese visitation overall has been down. So we're sort of counter to the trend.
Lawrence says Alaska has been an exception because of the direct JAL service, which is less expensive than other international travel options out of Japan. That, combining with a weak dollar, is making the U.S. more appealing place to vacation for foreign tourists. Japan has doubled the trips it makes to Alaska since it first started coming to the state back in 2003. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to aprn.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to tell us if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Diana Borrow in Haines, Rosemarie Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Menaker. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us here at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
Attention voters! Tuesday, August 26th is primary election day. Polling places will be open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, call 1-888-383-8683 or in Anchorage 269-8683. For additional information or other accommodations, please contact the Division of Elections at 907-465-4611, TTY TDD 907-465-3020. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.